Whatever the merits of individual authors whom we might name, isn't science itself a worthy subject for the best writers, more than capable of inspiring great literature? And whatever the qualities that make science so, those same qualities that make for great poetry and Nobel-winning novels, don't we have here a good approach to the meaning of soul? Spiritual is another word that could be used to describe Sagan-esque literary science. It is widely thought that physicists are more likely to self-identify as religious than biologists. There's even statistical evidence of this from the fellows of both the Royal Society of London and the US National Academy of Sciences. But experience suggests that if you probe these elite scientists further, you'll find that even the 10% who profess some kind of religiosity have, in most cases, no supernatural beliefs, no God, no creator, no aspiration to an afterlife. What they do have, and they'll say so if pressed, is a spiritual awareness. They may be fond of the hackneyed phrase, awe and wonder, and who can blame them? They may quote, as I do in these pages, the Indian astrophysicist Subramanian Chandrasekhar, shuddering before the beautiful, or the American physicist John Archibald Wheeler.
Behind it all is surely an idea so simple, so beautiful, that when we grasp it, in a decade, a century, or a millennium, we will all say to each other, how could it have been otherwise? How could we have been so blind?
Einstein himself made it very clear that, though spiritual, he believed in no kind of personal God.
It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world so far as our science can reveal it.
And on another occasion?
I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion.
Though I wouldn't use the exact phrase, it is in this sense of a deeply religious non-believer that I consider myself a spiritual person. And it is in this sense that I unapologetically use soul in the title of this book. Science is both wonderful and necessary. Wonderful for the soul, in contemplation, say, of deep space and deep time from the rim of the Grand Canyon, but also necessary for society, for our well-being, for our short-term and long-term future. And both aspects are represented in this anthology. I've been a science educator all my adult life, and most of the essays connected here stem from the years when I was the inaugural Charles Simony Professor of the Public Understanding of Science. When promoting science, I've long been an advocate of what I call the Carl Sagan school of thought, the visionary, poetic side of science, science to stir the imagination, as opposed to the non-stick frying pan school of thought. By the latter, I mean the tendency to justify the expense of, for example, space exploration by reference to spin-offs such as the non-stick frying pan, a tendency I've compared to an attempt to justify music as good exercise for the violinist's right arm. It's cheap and demeaning, and I suppose my satirical description could be accused of exaggerating the cheapness. But I still use it to express my preference for the romance of science. To justify space exploration, I would rather invoke what Arthur C. Clarke extolled and John Wyndham named as the outward urge, the modern version of the urge that drove Magellan, Columbus, and Vasco da Gama to exploring the unknown. But yes, non-stick frying pan is unfairly demeaning to the school of thought that it labels in my shorthand, and it is to the serious practical value of science in our society that I now turn, for that is what many of the essays in this book are about. Science really matters for life. And by science, I mean not just scientific facts, but the scientific way of thinking. I write this in November 2016, bleak month in a bleak year, when the phrase, barbarians at the gate, tempts without irony. Within the gates, rather, for the calamities that have struck the two most populous nations in the English-speaking world in 2016 are self-inflicted, wounds dealt not by an earthquake or a military coup d'etat, but by the democratic process itself. More than ever, reason needs to take center stage. Far be it from me to devalue emotion. I love music, literature, poetry, and the warmth, both mental and physical, of human affection. But emotion should know its place. Political decisions, decisions of state, policies for the future should flow from clear thinking, rational considerations of all the options, the evidence bearing upon them, and their likely consequences. Gut feelings, even when they don't arise from the stirred, dark waters of xenophobia, misogyny, or other blind prejudice, should stay out of the voting booth. For some time now, such murky emotions have remained largely under the surface. But in 2016, political campaigns on both sides of the Atlantic brought them into the open, made them, if not respectable, at least freely expressed. Demagogues led by example and proclaimed open season for prejudices which had for half a century been shamed into hole-in-corner secrecy. Whatever may be the innermost feelings of individual scientists, science itself works by rigorous adherence to objective values. There is objective truth out there, and it is our business to find it. Science has in place disciplined precautions against personal bias, confirmation bias, prejudgment of issues before the facts are in. Experiments are repeated. Double-blind trials exclude the pardonable desires of scientists to be proved right, and the more laudable bending over backwards to maximize our opportunity to be proved wrong. An experiment done in New York can be replicated by a lab in New Delhi, and we expect the conclusion to be the same, regardless of geography or the cultural or historic biases of the scientists. Would that other academic disciplines such as theology could say the same. Philosophers happily speak of continental philosophy as opposed to analytical philosophy. Philosophy departments in American or British universities might seek a new appointment to cover the continental tradition. Can you imagine a science department advertising for a new professor to cover continental chemistry or the Eastern tradition in biology? The very idea is a bad joke. That says something about the values of science and is not kind to those of philosophy.